Good morning, Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller, who's winging his way back from Canada, where he has been playing golf for a few days. He'll be back with us tomorrow. And we'll continue a tradition that we have on some holidays of talking about our resident and migrant birds of Wisconsin. Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County is a former president and current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. And it's a pleasure to have you here on the phones with us, Noel.
Great to be with you, Jim.
I know you've just gotten back from a trip out east where you were talking birds again.
Yes, I flew out to New Jersey to pick up my son, who was the hawk counter at Sandy Hook, New Jersey, for New Jersey Audubon this spring. And then we winded our way back through New Jersey and visited Brigantine Refuge and saw tens of thousands of shorebirds, came back through Long Island, was able to stop at Cornell and had a behind-the-scenes tour of the new Laboratory of Ornithology building. And then we attended a Great Lakes Raptor Conference in western New York and returned home last night.
Sounds like an active schedule. And Bill Volkert is a wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horican Marsh National Wildlife Area. Bill, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Jim. Always great to be back.
And, of course, you're in your new offices at the Education Center at Horican Marsh.
Yes, we are. We've moved in within, barely the past 6 weeks. It's a $5 million facility on the edge of Horican Marsh. We're right between the cities of Horican and Mayville on Highway 28. It was 17 years worth of planning efforts, about a year and a half worth of construction, and after all this time, the new Horican Marsh International Education Center is finally open to the public.
Mm-hmm. And what will this building enable you to do that you couldn't do before?
Well, we are able to do the education programs on a year-round basis because for so many years that I've been here, we did whatever the weather would allow. And in our old facility, I had one single basement room that served as both conference room, meeting room, lunch room, and my only classroom. So I've got dedicated education space. We've got an auditorium with a very high-tech audio-visual system into it. So it's not just year-round programming, but the programs we've always done, we're able to do in a much more elaborate fashion, and it gives us an opportunity to do different kinds of programs that we've never been able to do before. So it'll be a tremendous growth even in the education program here.
If you'd like to join the conversation to talk about ornithology, talk about birds, all you have to do, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And if you'd like to use the email, that address is talk@wpr.org as we talk with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Certainly the bird migration was in full swing this month across Wisconsin, Noel, as lots of people were seeing many, many, many bird species.
Well, one of the biggest complaints about May is it does not have enough weekends because, May is the time to really be out to catch the heights of migration when many of our species are either passing through our state to nest on north of us or to return the state to conduct their breeding season when they our chief aim is to raise young. So, yeah, May is just a glorious time to be in Wisconsin. And usually the second and third week is the peak, even though, of course, we have migration that starts in the wintertime, actually, and we'll still see some migrants going through as late as into mid-June.
What was the most unusual sighting you've had in the last week, Bill Volkert?
Oh, let me see. Good question there. Well, probably the most unusual here at Horican Marsh is that I believe we still have a bufflehead, which is a small duck, in a wood duck box.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it there several weeks ago with the school crews, group that I had, and I just made the casual statement. I said, well, if this bird actually pulls off a brood here, it'll be the first time that we've ever had him nest in Wisconsin. And I just wanted to double-check my memory on that, and indeed it would be.
Mm-hmm.
They nest in the spruce forest of Canada. This bird is about 300-400 miles south of where it should be, and why it took a liking to our wood duck box is, I guess, beyond me. But as far as I know, I think she's still in there, and I think she's incubating eggs at this point.
Oh, that's great.
And I also have a pair of sapsuckers nesting in my backyard just below the house. They're in a dead ironwood tree, and that's also a little bit further south than the normal range for that bird.
The lines are filling up. We'll go to the phones in just a moment as we talk with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. Bill, I understand that All but one pair of a dozen pair of whooping cranes left their nests in the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge in recent weeks. The same thing happened last year, didn't it?
Yes, and as I was talking to some of the biologists, they said it seems to be coinciding with a large hatch of black flies, and they don't know if that's in any way interfering with the birds, but for some reason, they got up and walked away from the nests. One pair is attempting a second nesting now. So this is really the difficult point now in this whole program. We've been able to take the eggs from the wild or from paired birds, some of them in captivity, incubate them, rear them in relative isolation, get them outside, and train them to migrate. But to actually now have a population that will breed on its own and start to raise its own young, that's the next big hurdle. And, of course, these are birds that are basically learning all of this with human help here. And so when it comes to this point now of actually going through the whole breeding, nesting, and rearing of young, they're all inexperienced, and they're having a tough time, really, trying to really go all the way through that full nesting cycle and successfully incubate eggs and perhaps raise any young. And, yeah, it's a little tough because we've got enough birds now that are of age. They're at least 5 years old, and they are mature. And at this point, we're just not seeing the large numbers of birds actually successfully rearing any young.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take some phone calls because the lines are now full. We'll go to Vivian in Brussels. Hello, Vivian.
Hi, good morning. This is a wonderful program. I'm just delighted. We have a place that's actually between Brussels and like Dykesville on Green Bay on the shore, and very fortunate to year-round watch the migration of the birds. And what I saw this spring, this is the second time I've seen it, were thousands of cormorants traveling with hundreds of pelicans. And as I said, this is the second time I've seen it. Last year we just saw a lot of cormorants, maybe three or four pelicans traveling with them. But this year they seem to come through all together. And I just wondered if this is a usual occurrence or if this is something new or what might be happening there.
Which of you gentlemen would like to pick up the answer to that?
Well, I don't think either species is seeking the other species out to travel with. I think it's just the fact that populations of cormorants are high right now in Wisconsin, and pelican population continues to increase in the state. So I think it was just you caught them when they were both moving north, and they happened to be flying together.
Probably in the same storm system or wind flow, correct?
They're probably using the same, they were probably flying on favorable winds, so yes, they're taking advantage of the winds to move north.
All right, let's go to Bob next in Eau Claire. Bob, what can we do for you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, and happy Memorial Day to all.
Thank you.
Yeah, about a week and a half or 2 weeks ago, we had a pair of brown thrashers move in. We're south of the city, the actual city of Eau Claire, about maybe 3-4 miles. We live in a kind of a semi-residential area, and our particular yard is surrounded by evergreens. And when I first saw the thrashers, I thought, oh, well, maybe they're just moving through on the migration. But they're here. They're staying. And, in fact, the male, I've never heard the male brown thrasher's song before. It is a very complicated song. It's a beautiful, gorgeous thing to hear. And it goes on for quite a while before it starts making a repetition. Very melodious, kind of a cross between maybe a robin and a wood thrush with maybe a little bit of a cardinal even thrown in there. It's got a lot of elements to the song.
Hmm. Well, they're one of our mimids, so they will repeat the songs of other birds that are around them, and some are quite good vocalists, and you can pick out a lot of different notes. One of the ways to distinguish the song of brown thrashers from gray catbirds is that they tend to repeat the phrases in twos, whereas catbirds are just more of a jumbly mix of sounds. thrasher's repeat, and you can tell it that way. You know, brown thrashers nest throughout Wisconsin. They nest in old fields, brushy areas. It's a species that's declining as our shrub habitat declines in the state. I was involved with a birdathon at the River Ridge Nature Center a week ago, and I actually found a brown thrasher nest right on the ground, and it had two eggs in it. So this is the time of year that they're nesting either on the ground or in a small shrub, or it's quite low to the ground generally.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at the Audubon, Madison Audubon Society's list of birds that have been seen in this month, and we also have that same bird in this area, the brown thrasher.
Right.
So it's apparently not an isolated sighting.
Well, they're widely scattered, depending on that shrub habitat. And as Noel says, as a lot of our forests are maturing, they're losing some of that. But forest edges and thickets, and it may be right in the far corner of a backyard or out somewhere in the edges of the large forest.
Talking about birds today with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, Bill Volkert at the Horican Marsh National Wildlife Area. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number for you is 800-642-1234. And let's go to Arlene next in New Berlin. Hello, Arlene.
Hello. Happy Memorial Day
to you all. Thank you.
The reason I called is I have about three or four bird feeders in my yard, and about a week ago, one bird came, and then later on two birds came. I've never seen it before. It is black on the head and goes down the neck. It does not have a straight bill. It has more of a curved bill, and then on the underneath the neck where all the black goes, there's a little bit of red, and then on the back of it, I think, and part of the wings, there's a little white with the black, and I don't know what it is, and I haven't been able to. I don't have a bird book, so I don't know what it is. But one of them came to eat at the bird feeder, and then a couple of days later, two more came, and I'd like to know what they are.
The beak is
real. But I'll take my answer off the air.
It's a heavy cardinal-like beak?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
I think we got that one, don't we, Bill?
I think so. Rose-breasted grosbeak.
Oh, boy.
And this is the male.
I've never seen them before, and we've been here for 5 years, and it was really very interesting.
This is one of those birds that will come to the bird feeder the first few days when they arrive.
Uh-huh.
So it's a true tropical migrant. They will spend their winter down in Central America.
Oh.
And they'll arrive almost always around that first week of May.
Uh-huh.
And when they first get here, there's not always a lot of food available. And, of course, birds are exhausted from the long journeys. So they will hit the bird feeders for a while. And right after that, the natural food becomes more abundant. They tend to move up more into the treetops. And this is typical of a lot of our so-called tropical birds, in that when we think of tropical birds, they're brilliantly colored, mm-hmm. and yet they're able to hide themselves because they're in the dense rainforest. Well, the scarlet tanager, rose-breasted grosbeak, little indigo bunting, they all have these intensive colors, but they move into the dense treetops as we get into the summer nesting season. And so what you'll notice is now that the leaves are nearly full, you'll hear the birds,
uh-huh.
but they're really difficult to see. But for that short time, when they arrive, they'll come to the feeders and a chance for you to be able to enjoy them.
Yeah, it was really wonderful. Thank you.
Arlene. One thing to look at also is that the female looks completely different than the male.
Oh, really?
So if you have a bird the same size as the bird you just described, but it's all brown and white with various stripes and so forth, that will be the female.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very
much. Arlene, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. And if you'd like to join in, there's a line open, 800-642-1234. I'm Jim Packard. Brittany DeAnda is our on-air producer today, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network as we talk about birds, our resident and the migrant birds going through Wisconsin. Noel Cutright, Bill Volkert, our guests. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number for you is 800-642-1234. Bill, the EPA took another step in the campaign to prohibit the sale of the highly toxic pesticide carbuforin, which is sold under the name Furadin by FMC Corporation. That rule will become final at the end of the year, pending an appeal by FMC. A risk assessment showed that all legal uses of carbuforin would likely kill wild birds. Is that something that you've noticed as a problem?
I can't say that I've noticed it directly, but there certainly has been concern for various kinds of pesticides that affect birds in different ways, and certainly some of these that are used very broadly in large agricultural areas for certain kinds of crops. There's always that risk of exposure to wildlife, and some of these we do know can be quite fatal to wildlife. And there have been a number of others that have been very specific in terms of their impacts. There was a pesticide in South America that did a decimation on Swainson hawks. There was something more recently of pesticides in India that were doing a tremendous job on the lammergeier, which is a vulture. In just 5 years, a tremendous decline. And something like, as you're saying, the furan is something that's been used very broadly, which is not a single species, but definitely, you know, some concerns over the variety of birds that are exposed to the pesticides in the environment.
At one time, carbuforin was in a dry form in granulars or pellets, and birds would pick it up thinking it was an insect or a seed of some kind, and one grain could kill a bird. So the granular form was banned in 91, so it's just taken until now to come out and ban all forms here in the U.S., we'll see. And hopefully, it's one of the chemicals that I've written to the EPA about and suggested that it should be banned just because it is so toxic to many bird species, or all bird species, really.
And apparently, you've gotten some results then.
Yeah, and keep in mind that, you know, for most of our birds, even some of what we consider to be very large birds, for their body size, a lot of them are very lightweight. There's not a lot of bulk there. They've got a high body temperature and a fast metabolism. And as a result, they tend to absorb and process some of these types of things very quickly. And, of course, living their whole life out in the environment, there can be a tremendous exposure. And so birds are very susceptible to it. And on one hand, we certainly use them so-called as a barometer of what's happening in the environment. But there's also that risk of high exposure and, of course, the resultant population declines.
All right, back to the phones to Pat in Dallas. Pat, what's on your mind?
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
Say, I've got a question about evening grosbeaks. We've been living here for 30-some years, and for many years, 25 years or so, every spring or so, the evening grosbeaks would come in the spring, and then they'd come back in the fall. Now, the last couple of years, we haven't seen an evening grosbeak, so I was just wondering, are their populations way down? And same with the whippoorwills. We don't hear whippoorwills anymore. I was just wondering if those populations are way down and why we might not be seeing them anymore.
Well, thank you about the whippoorwill question. I think we receive a call on that every Memorial Day and very often the 4th of July, too. I'll respond to that first and make a comment about evening grosbeaks. But whippoorwills have definitely declined. There's been several suggested reasons, but I don't think anyone really has a good handle on that. Starting last year, we have started a survey, breeding bird survey, to focus just on whippoorwills and common nighthawks, another related species that's also declining in the state, so we can start obtaining some reliable data and to better know what's happening to our whippoorwill populations. But they are definitely down, not only in Wisconsin, but I think throughout its range. Evening grosbeaks are kind of interesting. At one time, you would see evening grosbeaks really flooding into feeders throughout the northern half of the state, and some years they would come down into the southern part of the state also to feed on sunflower seeds. They nest uncommonly in the northern part of the state, but we have seen also a decline in evening grosbeaks, again, not only here in Wisconsin, but throughout the eastern U.S., even though out west, evening grosbeaks seem to be doing okay. It's another one that we just don't understand why they have declined, but surveys of various kinds indicate that they are definitely declining. On the Breeding Bird Atlas, we found them breeding throughout about the two tiers of counties across the northern part of the state. So we definitely had them breeding in the state, but definitely declined over the last few decades.
Well, the peculiar thing with evening grosbeaks, and I think this is something that is stumping some of the scientists, is that they tend to be mostly associated with these northern forests, southern Canada, far northern Wisconsin, and then coming down the Rocky Mountains. And while there certainly is rotational timbering in some of these areas, there aren't overall large-scale land use changes. And we don't know why these birds in what seem to be a relatively stable habitat are declining. And that one seems to miff us a little bit.
You mentioned the Breeding Bird Atlas. Noel, let's for people who aren't familiar with it, let's talk about what it is. And it's just a year or so old now, isn't it?
Yeah, it came out, actually it came out in 2006, but it's the result of all the field effort put in by thousands of observers in Wisconsin combining or covering the entire state to try to determine what birds are breeding where. So between 1995 and 2000, we had people spread out determining that, and we put all the data together. With a lot of help from a lot of people and computers and everything else, and came out with a book in 2006. It's about a 600-page book that covers what's happening in Wisconsin from a breeding bird standpoint. So it's kind of the Bible that people are using now, and it'll be exciting when we repeat this in, well, maybe another decade to see what changes we've seen in the breeding bird distribution of birds. Other states are in the middle or are winding up. They're second tier, and it's amazing some of the changes that they have seen. And of course, some states, we just mentioned Whippoorwill, they're seeing definite declines in the second Breeding Bird Atlas compared to the one that was done first maybe 20 years prior to that. So that's the way we have of trying to document some of the changes and determining why and maybe trying to take steps to reverse those trends.
Vera in Ladysmith is next. Hello, Vera.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just wondered if you could maybe help me figure out what I'm seeing. I live right on the Flambeau River up in the Northwoods, and I have lots of woodpeckers all the time, downies and hairies and red-bellied, and I even have a pair of pileated that visit my suet feeders all the time. But a couple of weeks ago, I had a new pair of downy woodpeckers show up, and these are definitely downy. They're not sapsuckers. I have a pair of those, too. But the female of this pair, you know, they both have the black crown, and then there is usually, like, I guess you'd call it an eyebrow stripe. She has a bright lemon yellow stripe, just like a goldfinch, and she also has the same color on her flanks and rump and undertail coverts and outermost tail feathers and outermost primary. And the male is the same. Of course, he's got the red nape, and he's also got more of this coloring on his shoulders. But he's not lemon yellow. He's more like a lemony orangey color, I'd say, on those parts of his body. So would you call this a different race, or is it a different a mutation, or what would you call it?
It would just be simply a mutation for
the bird.
Okay, And whether this now starts to show up among their young, and this is something that is more prevalent in the population, we'll have to see if that's a genetic trait that's being passed on. When you talk about a race, what we're looking at is a whole population of birds then within the region that share that trait.
Why I'm calling. I didn't know if you had ever heard of anything like that.
Well, there actually was a downy woodpecker that was being watched. I think it was on west of the Madison area that was very brownish rather than black a few years ago. And so some of these birds do show a little bit of variation, and especially like the downy or hairy woodpecker that tend to have predominantly just black and white.
Right.
Have any variation in those colors is certainly unusual. But, you know, again, if you have a fair population of birds, you will start to see individual differences. And so especially in abundant birds, we tend to hear more often about these unusual color variations. So Canada geese, robins, some of our blackbirds. Here we'll hear about birds that are partial albino, kind of unusual color patterns that may show up. And it's just the genetics are just a roll of the dice. And that's why it tends to show up that much more prevalently in these very large populations, because it's, as I tell people, it may be a mutation that may show up one in a million. Well, in our Canada geese, we've got a million birds out there. So
right.
Something could show up. And I guess in almost any of the birds, there's always that odd chance of something showing up like that as a slight variation. the nice thing about it is that now that individual stands out from everybody else, and we can actually track it a little bit, where otherwise we require to have to actually capture and mark the
bird so
we can distinguish
them. Well, yeah, I've been birding for 40 years, and I've never seen something go against, you know, what they're supposed to look like.
Well, maybe we could say it's something that only shows up once in 40 years in a person's observations, too. You know, that's a very low chance, but there you go.
All right, Vera, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. As we talk with Bill Volkert of the Horican Marsh National Wildlife Area, Noel Cutright, who's the former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Let's go to Patricia in Madison. Hello, Patricia.
Hello. Happy Memorial Day to you.
Thank you.
I'm in the Madison area and wondering if the hummingbirds have come through here yet. On Mother's Day, I was at my family's in Ozaukee County, and the hummingbirds were there, so I'm a little jealous. And also, I'm wondering, is there a way to keep the ants from getting into the hummingbird feeder?
Well, hummingbirds definitely came through Madison area. They would be pretty much the same timing, right around the 1st of May, the first ones show up, with probably the peak of the migration occurring all during the middle to the last half of May. There are hummingbird feeders with ant guards that you can purchase, so ants cannot climb down the stem of the feeder and get into the sugar water. So they can be equipped with ant guards.
And someone else has a question about hummingbirds. That's Kim in Oshkosh. Kim, what can we do for you?
I was just calling to say that I had a sighting of a hummingbird this morning at Clam Lake, so they're definitely here. And I was going to ask that you talk about them a little bit, so thank you.
All
I'll
right.
hang up and listen.
All right, thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Anything more to add about hummingbirds?
Well, we could talk the rest of the hour on hummingbirds. Well, interestingly, they are found only in the Western Hemisphere, and there are more than 320 species in the whole world. Most of them are in South America, and the number one country would be Ecuador. They've got almost 132 species on their list. Wisconsin, well, one of regular occurrence, which is our ruby-throated hummingbird, and that is a true tropical migrant, and believe it or not, that little bird goes all the way down into Central America, spends its winter there, and comes back, and oftentimes right back to the same backyard, the same feeders. And perhaps that kind of territoriality of the birds is why the previous caller may not have seen so-called their hummingbird. I've heard this in the past, and I think we've had it on the show, too, where some people will have a new arrival in one year that they haven't seen. Others will have so-called lost their hummingbird. And this might actually be the loss of those individuals over the wintertime and wait for somebody else to reoccupy that territory again and take advantage of the feeders.
Corrine in La Crosse, let's give you a chance. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question in regards to finch feeders. I had a small finch feeder with just two feeding ports, and the finches seem to be coming to it quite readily, so I purchased a different one that has a few more ports to it, and they don't seem to be coming to it as frequently. And I'm just kind of wondering if you had some suggestions for, you know, a type of finch feeder, or maybe I have it in the wrong location. I have it next to another bird feeder, or any suggestions.
Okay. All right.
Well, the number of openings shouldn't really make a difference on that, but it may be designed a little bit differently. Location can be important, especially if they get accustomed to a feeder in one particular spot. It may take them a little bit longer to get used to another one, or the cover that they may fly back and forth between the vegetation and the feeder itself may be a little bit different pattern. Maybe they don't feel quite as comfortable or as safe from potential predators in the new location. You may, if it doesn't seem to be all that successful, just try moving it around and see if you can find maybe a spot that they find more attractive. But the number of openings certainly should not affect birds not choosing one with more openings, for example, compared to your one with two. So just experiment a little bit and move it around some and see what happens.
One other thing to consider is that the winter flocks are breaking up a little bit, so perhaps you had more birds several weeks ago when they were still hanging together a little bit more in flocks, and now we've got birds tending to uh, to move around and pair off. So during the summertime, you certainly will have less visiting than you do during the fall, winter, and early spring.
All right. Catherine in Delafield, let's get you into the conversation. Go ahead.
Hello. My question is regarding robins. I seem to have robins that build nests right by my doors, my front and my back door, and no matter what I do to discourage them, they keep putting the nest back there until finally I give up and they have their babies. But, you know, I'm always taking the dogs out or, you know, people are coming in and out. Why do they persist in building their nests in such a busy area? And does it affect, you know, their brooding of the eggs?
Well, obviously, I think your light provides a nice platform to place the nest on. You know, they typically like to have a flat surface or somewhat a substantial surface to place a rather large nest with. It has quite a bit of mud in it, so it's a rather heavy nest as nests go. And obviously, looking at all the locations around your yard and around your house, that location that they choose all the time is it provides them the best opportunity. You can put up shelves sometimes in other locations, maybe to move them a little farther away from the doorway and put something on the light fixture so they really can't place their nest there. So sometimes you can move them, but they get very accustomed to comings and goings and pets and kids around and noise, and it seems like they bring off their young quite well, even when the doors are opening and things are happening around. But you may be able to, in future years, don't disturb them once they start nesting, but in future years you may want to experiment by putting up maybe something that resembles your light somewhere else that you would find a little bit more convenient.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Dwayne in Almond, let's go to you next. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi, Almond Center.
Okay.
But they're both in western Wisconsin. Yes, I two major topics here. One, I've noticed no decline at all in my birds. Whippoorwill is here, and all the other that I've seen for the past 20 years are here in numbers and species just about the same as in the past. So maybe I'm fortunate there. And then my second topic here is some unusual birds that have come through. And just this year I saw a red-headed woodpecker at my feeder, which is, I don't know if I've seen any since my youth. And then I also have had a merlin during the winter, which is a raptor, of course. And he's been here several years feeding on my juncos. And then a couple years ago, I had a flock of Cape May warblers that came through. And that's the first time I've seen them, and I have never seen them since. So if you would like to comment on those species, go ahead.
Sure.
Well, it's certainly nice that you have plenty of birds around. And when we say a species declining, that tends to really highlight what's happening across their range in a particular region. It does not say that in a particular local area they're declining. And, of course, a species will decline last in those habitats that they find the most suitable and really provide all the requirements they need. So they tend to lose out on kind of the edges of the range and where it's the requirements are not met as good as in real good habitat. So it's great that you're seeing a lot of birds around, and I'm sure Bill can comment too, but red-headed woodpeckers are a species that have declined throughout the range, but there are still some strongholds like Nacito National Wildlife Refuge in the central part of the state where there's work on restoration of oak savanna, which is a type of habitat they really like to nest in. So there are still some strongholds for red-headed woodpeckers. We always have a few merlin. The merlin is a kind of a falcon, larger than a kestrel, smaller than a peregrine. They nest now in the northern third of Wisconsin. But we always get a few that overwinter, and they typically will set up in kind of one territory and feed on house sparrows or some, as you mentioned, junco. That would certainly be an ideal species for them to capture. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's not the same individual that has found your location to its liking and hangs around for the winter. And Cape May warblers, as Jim talked about in the opening, this week, in the last few weeks, we've had maybe 30 different species of warblers moving through the state. Many of these are birds that overwinter south of the United States and come back in during spring to conduct their breeding habits throughout the North America. And Cape May, like many of our warblers, the name doesn't do a whole lot to describe the bird. It was first described when it was seen in Cape May, but they don't even nest in Cape May. But they do nest in the northern part of Wisconsin, and really, really an attractive species. So to find more than one or two, or as you said, finding them in a flock, you're really fortunate.
Duane, thanks very much for the call. We did have an email from Susan in Bangor. Please tell me where I can report whippoorwills. We have them in our valley every year. I would be interested in their distribution. If someone has a sighting like that and are interested in getting the word out, where do they go?
Well, the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology keeps the statewide records of birds, so unusual occurrences as well as seasonal occurrences, and they do put together a seasonal summary. As Noel mentioned earlier, when the Breeding Bird Atlas project is repeated again, that's certainly what we're going to be interested in. And then you have the Cornell University with its eBird, the electronic bird tracking system, looking at basically bird watchers and their checklists and using that as a database of bird occurrences and the frequencies which they're shown, they're sighted. And so we're actually trying to find a way that bird watchers, in other words, millions of people with binoculars and interest of birds, can use their sightings as some sort of reflection of bird population and distributions. And so check Cornell University and eBird.
All right.
Yeah, you can go to eBird.org, and we actually have a Wisconsin eBird that you can submit observations. It's a great place to keep track of your sightings on a particular property or your life list or ever how you maintain. It's just, and Wisconsin's really wonderful. The birders here in Wisconsin, it ranks right up to close of any state in the country as far as number of checklists observed. In fact, the current month, I'm here at a computer and I'm looking at the eBird site for Wisconsin. Milwaukee County submitted over 6,000 checklists for the current month. Dane County, 525. Even up in Florence County, one of our not very populated counties up in the northeastern part of Wisconsin, 110 checklists. So it's a great place to report your sightings, and it organizes it for you and allows other people to share in the data also.
We're talking with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County. He's the former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and is the senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Bill Volkert is a wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horican Marsh National Wildlife Area. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wishing you a happy Memorial Day. This is Jim Packard on the Ideas Network as we talk about ornithology, our resident migrant birds of Wisconsin, with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number for you is 800-642-1234. The email address is talk@wpr.org. We go back to the phones to Pam in Elkhorn next. Pam, what can we do for you?
Hi. We just added on an addition. And we have a pair of cardinals that continue to attack the windows nonstop. They just beat into the windows, fall to the ground, get up, and do it all over again all day long.
It's a common occurrence, especially among cardinals, robins, and the goldfinches. And it's what I've been referring to for years, shadow boxing. What you have are the males right now are defending a territory. They'll try to keep any other male out of that area, and he's simply seeing his reflection. And it can be somewhat exhausting for the birds and certainly annoying for the people indoors. Best thing you can do is to try to find some sort of deterrent to keep that bird away from those windows, such as streamers or things like that, or find a way to be able to block that view of the bird of those windows without, of course, having to seal yourself into the house. They can be very persistent. It can be very annoying if they continue through much of the summer. They'll start early in the morning, especially on your weekends. And basically, like anything else, as a nuisance problem, you've got to be about as persistent as the bird is to try to break them of that habit.
Noel, anything to add to that?
No, I think Bill covered it. Some people, it seems like they try one thing and find success right away. others will run through a number of attempts. Some birds are just more persistent than others. And even in cardinals, you mentioned even the females do some defending of the territory. Sometimes you even have female cardinals attacking the window. So sometimes just drawing the blinds or shades, or, as Bill said, putting something that moves outside, hanging it down from the eaves or someplace nearby to try to break up that image that the bird sees of himself can work. But as Bill says, boy, you have to be persistent, and sometimes it just seems like you just can't come up with any solution.
Yeah. I'll mention real quickly that it's easy for us to sit here and try to give that advice, and I can tell you last year I had one that was just had a terrible habit. My wife and I tried everything. We finally just gave up and let him tap on the windows for a while. This year, I think it's the same bird. He found the mirrors on my truck, and fortunately, I parked that a bit of a distance from the house, so I just leave him there. He doesn't seem to be quite as obsessed as he was last year, but there are some birds, as Noel said, that will have much more persistent habit than others, and it can be frustrating at times, so you have my sympathy.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying. My auto mirrors were being attacked by cardinals a couple of years ago, who just found that wonderful to have a reflection of themselves to peck at. But
what I found it works, though it can be a little annoying, is I take bread bags with a rubber band, put them over the mirrors, and cover them up.
Uh-huh.
The only annoying thing is every time you start the car, you've
got to take the bag
the
off.
Over the mirror, so it can be a little bit of a hassle, but it can break the bird of it.
Fred in Watersmeet, Michigan. Let's go to you next. Hi, Fred.
Hi, guys. Well, I'm at my cabin on a lake up here, and I want everybody to know the hummingbirds are in force here.
Mm-hmm.
And I fill four feeders, tube feeders, in the morning, and they're empty by night. So we have tons of goldfishes and pine siskins, and we've got grosbeaks coming in. But one of the first question is on the grosbeak, on the rose-breasted. We think it's the mate, the female, but my wife saw it, and it had like a tawny yellow patch on the breast. Is that characteristic of the female rose-breasted grosbeak that had that little pale yellow?
Oh, I can take this. We talked earlier that the female is a much more drab color, just sort of a blotched
Right. Brown
and a whitish color.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you will see the males coming back in their very first year. It requires the first full year for them to get that actual color with the rose breast. So they may come back with more brownish in the head and back and slowly start to come into full breeding color. And in some of the females, you will get a little bit of a yellowish-type wash or tint to it.
Okay. A couple other questions. Can you feed soot to the birds year-round? I know they attract the woodpeckers, but we noticed this spring that some of the insect-eating birds would be pecking at some of the soot particles that fell on our deck.
You can, but it does get a little messy as the temperatures rise. You know, soot kind of gets very soft and will actually kind of melt under high temperatures. Some of the processed suet blocks, I think, withstand higher temperatures, and just when you use regular kidney suet. But if you want to go ahead and deal with it, it's fine to put it out. But it can get a little messy. You may want to choose a shady location to keep it out of the sun to try to keep it more solid.
I might also suggest you use a little less of it than you would in winter, because you're not going to have the large flocks of birds coming at it, and it can spoil on a bit and become, as Noel says, quite a bit of a mess. So you might want to dole out a little bit less of it at a time.
Okay, one final question. For those people out there that maybe are just getting into birding, what power magnification on binoculars do you guys recommend?
Well, that's a personal preference. I think for many years the standard was 7 power, and 10 power was kind of the other option, which tend to be quite a bit heavier binoculars. But in recent years, you're seeing a lot of 8 and 8.5 power binoculars coming out with still decent weight to them. So I think you're seeing more and more birders going to 8 power or 8.5 power versus 7. It gives you just a little bit boost in magnification and still not as heavy as 10-power binoculars. So myself, I started out with 8, and they broke. I got it has a lifetime guarantee, so they quit making 8s. They make 8.5s now. So Mine that I'm using here for the last few years are 8.5.
Also keep in mind that as you get higher magnification, your field of view narrows a bit, so you're zooming in a little bit on a tighter area. And for beginning and intermediate birders, especially those people who have a hard time always drawing those things quickly to the eye and finding the bird, you've got now a narrower field of view. And also, as you magnify both the image, unless you get image stabilization, any shaking as you're holding it, and you're just that fatigue of holding it, you magnify that shake as well. So there's a point of diminishing returns as you continue to magnify them as well. I guess the best thing is what works for you. I wouldn't go less than 7. You'd want to have a pretty good image, but there's so many styles, shapes, brands out there. Whatever's going to be the best for you.
One species you mentioned is really quite interesting this year, and that's the pine siskin. This is a species that we very often see only during the winter or maybe in the fall and spring. You have to be pretty much in the middle or in the northern part of the state to see pine siskins in the summertime. But we had such a large influx of pine siskins throughout Wisconsin during the winter. A number of those have stayed around, and we probably have had more breeding bird records of pine siskins in the southern half of the state than has ever been recorded. We had, as I mentioned earlier, we had a birdathon, bandathon at River Edge Nature Center last weekend, and we actually caught a young bird. Another person from the River Edge Bird Club has found 3 nests of pine siskin in his Christmas tree plantation this summer. So people that might not be used to seeing pine siskin around this time of year, especially in the southern half of the state, are being able to enjoy these birds. And I was out birding this morning and heard a couple pine siskin fly over. So it's just another thing that every year is different, and we have to take what comes and try to enjoy it and understand what's happening.
And probably one of the reasons for pine siskins to linger over is they bailed out of the Canadian spruce forest last winter because of such poor cone crop production. Well, there's no new cone crop coming until this summer, so why head back north and try to raise a family, especially if that low food supply may carry over for another year? So they're going to hang out here for a little bit.
That's to our advantage then.
Yes.
All right, let's go to Phil in Madison next. Phil, what's on your mind?
What a joy to be listening to you folks instead of doing my yard work. I was trimming my pear trees, getting the water suckers off, and I go from the bottom up, and I was up at the top of one tree, and lo and behold, here was a whole cup of water sprouts, and there was a nest up there. This is about, nearly 20 feet in the air. The bottom of the nest was all twigs, and it got up finer material, and it was a blue egg, one blue egg. And I've been looking to see if there's some bird doing some work. I don't think it was a robin because there was no mud in lining. What do you think? It was the size of a robin's egg.
Well, my first thought would be a gray catbird. Catbirds have very beautiful solid blue, and they tend to nest in pretty thick shrubbery or trees, and an area where you have a clump of water sprouts on a pear tree. It sounds like it might be a pretty ideal location for a catbird.
Well, I thought they laid eggs in other birds' nests.
No, cowbirds do.
Yeah, but that's more of a white speckled egg. Catbird, I should also mention, is not a sky blue.
It was pretty large for a catbird, I would think.
You think the egg was too large for a catbird? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Well, they wouldn't be that much different than a robin's egg.
Okay.
They're a little bit of a slimmer bird than a robin, but lengthwise they're pretty much the same. And look at the two eggs side by side. There wouldn't be that much difference. I think the catbird would be a little more intense or a darker blue, but definitely would be a solid blue color.
I can ladder up the horizontal branches. I'll check on this as time passes.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks, Phil. Appreciate hearing from you. If you'd like to join in, the number is 800-642-1234 as we talk with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. And let's go to Tom in Green Bay.
Hi, Bill and Noel.
Hi.
This is Tom Ridman up in
yes,
Green
sir.
Bay.
Oh, hey, Tom.
Go back to your original comment about your bufflehead. I would suggest you check out Milwaukee Museum. It's been a couple decades since I went through their egg collection, at least their cards, and they had a set of eggs collected by Benjamin Goss from, I think, back in the 1850s or 60s.
If you go to Wisconsin Bird Life, Sam Robbins' book, he does mention Benjamin Goss with a notation of a brood on Pewaukee Lake. No year given, no details.
Okay.
And so that seems somewhat of a hypothetical record. And otherwise, I have found nothing else in about three or four other references to indicate that we have an actual recorded, definitive nesting of that species. But, these things are scattered, especially the old records, as you know.
Well, a lot of the old records were never incorporated in Sam's book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, I have looked at a set of marbled godwit eggs that were collected up at Peshtigo. It's over at Stevens Point. Situation in Wisconsin has, dramatically changed in 150 years.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have the situation that we have so many people who've kept birds and in different, detail, some of them with very accurate, uniform, standard procedures, others just notations and observations, and this stuff is just all over. And trying to pull it all together is certainly a challenge, and a number of people have tried in different ways to sum up what we know of the bird life of Wisconsin, and that's why there's more than one reference here. And any one of those are going to be incomplete to some degree. But more and more we're trying to look at both historical records as well as come up with some uniform ways of monitoring birds these days so we can follow their trends, as the Breeding Bird Atlas certainly is trying to do.
We're talking with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, and we will continue to do so. We'll talk about ornithology after a look at the latest news. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today on Memorial Day as we continue to talk about resident and migrant birds of Wisconsin with Noel Cutright of Azaka County, the former president and current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Noel, again, my thanks to you for being with us.
Always love to be with you and all your listeners, Jim.
All right. And Bill Volkert is a wildlife educator, naturalist with the DNR Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horican Marsh National Wildlife Area. Bill, thank you for taking time on this holiday.
Wow, it's really my pleasure to be able to join you. Thanks.
Email from Gary in Rhinelander asks, a week ago we saw a scarlet tanager in the woods near our house. It's not often that we see these birds. I was fortunate enough to get some great photographs before he flew on. Is the bird considered uncommon in Wisconsin as a whole or just in northern Wisconsin?
It's a species that occurs throughout Wisconsin, both during migration and for breeding purposes. So, it's not an abundant bird, but it's certainly not uncommon either. You get in the right kind of habitat. They're primarily a bird of deciduous forests, so in those kind of habitats, they're found throughout the state. So it's always such a wonderful treat because in the tropics of Western Hemisphere, there are just so many species of tanagers, and many of them are very brightly colored. It's too bad we only have the one species here in the eastern United States that come as far north as Wisconsin. That's a scarlet tanager.
Mm-hmm.
This year we've had an interesting occurrence of summer tanagers, which is a species without the black wing. The males do not have black wings like the scarlet tanager does. They typically nest in the southern third of Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, but this spring we've had a large number of summer tanagers that have been reported during migration. We do have two other tanagers in the United States, a hepatic tanager, which is restricted to southwestern United States, and we have the western tanager, which we have a few records for here also in the state, and I believe there have been one or two records for Wisconsin this spring also.
Well, as Noel mentioned, tanagers in the tropics are a huge family, and we get these few that will travel this far north. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, typical of these so-called tropical birds, they love the dense cover, especially the treetops in the dense maple forest. So you'll see them early in spring when they first arrive, the leaves are just emerging, and then they seem to disappear from view. My hint would be, get familiar with the song, get to know their calling, and for the next month or so, you'll hear them up in the treetops in some of these dense forest areas. But they're going to be a tough sight, even with that just flame-colored orangish-red a plumage on it. It's still a hard bird to see in that real dense foliage.
Jim, let me mention, if I can, there's one handy booklet to have. If people really want to learn more about when birds arrive and whether they're abundant or uncommon, it's the sixth edition of Wisconsin Birds. a checklist with migration graphs. This is a small 36-page booklet that WSO has put out. I say this is a sixth edition. It not only has the abundance by month, it talks about habitat types and whether they're breeding in Wisconsin and so forth, and there's room in there to keep a life list or a property list or a monthly list or any kind of list. There's space in there for that. But it's only 50 cents. And I tell people it's the best bargain in the state, and people need about three of them. You need one for each car, one for the living room or near your feeders, and one for the bathroom. So it's just a wonderful little guide to just carry around. It fits in your back pocket or in your glove compartment, and it gives you so much information. It's only 50 cents. A lot of the nature centers sell it. I know the Wild Birds Unlimited store in Mequon has it available. But you can also order it through the mail, through the WSO website, wsobirds.org, and then go down to the bookstore area, and you can order it there through the mail for 50 cents plus postage.
It's such a fascinating website. I mean, you've got periodicals, research, education, conservation, the bookstore, sightings. So if you want to know exactly what's going on, you can just go to that each day and see the reports come in from around the state. And if there's something rare that you want to see, you can go out and see it.
Yes, and the bookstore does have copies of the Breeding Bird Atlas, as you mentioned, and a brand new book just came out. WSO published this newest edition of Wisconsin's Favorite Bird Haunts by Daryl Tesson, who lives in Appleton. That just came out another month ago, and Bill was fortunate to be able to host. It has some wonderful original artwork in it, and Bill was able to work to have a lot of this art on display at the new education center at Horicon. It's only $30. It's bigger than ever. It has the best birding spots in each county in Wisconsin.
Bill, sounds like you had your art show on display.
Well, yeah, it was a wonderful exhibit. Some very talented artists, and we were fortunate to have that coincide with the Horicon Marsh Bird Festival. So the peak of the song migration, the peak of our birding visitors here, and a chance to highlight the book and the artwork to introduce the people to the new edition. It's a great reference to get people around the state to find some of those special little areas where you can find birds. And as Noel said, every county and every little corner of the state. And we had a lot of good contributors with a lot of experience around the state sharing some of their favorite spots.
Well, let's go back to the phones. The number for you is 800-642-1234. Let's go to Maureen in Appleton next. Hi, Maureen.
Hi there. I'm really glad to have this program on today.
Uh-huh.
I've got a question, and then I have a comment. Regarding the wood thrush, what do they prefer for breeding? Because I have it, but I can't identify where they nest. I can't identify what they like, and I've never seen the bird. And I may be getting this confused with one other thrush. It is beautiful. Well, you hear the song when it starts getting later in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just beautiful, but I have never seen the bird. It's just there every year.
Well, wood thrushes nest in, again, it's a neotropical migrant that overwinters in the tropics, and it comes back to forested areas in the state, primarily deciduous forests. So you're in the Appleton area, right?
Right.
I'm trying to think of a good location where you might be able to go out and find wood thrushes. Bill, do you have any ideas near Appleton where she might be able to go to find a wood thrush?
How about Highcliff State Park?
Okay.
Might be a little more extensive forest. It's an interior forest bird, so they need generally larger forest stands. They will occasionally visit in migration smaller wood lots, and they may jump around if there's nothing else to be found, but they tend not to be real successful nesters in those areas because of high predator numbers. Yeah, it's just a beautiful flute-like song, and so some of the dense forest areas early in the morning would be the place to listen for it.
Okay, I only hear mine in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have is an acre and a half where we just had to give up on the mowing for, I'd say, a quarter of it, and it just got away, and it became a most beautiful woodland, and it's all deciduous trees. And so somewhere in there, it loves it. It's there every single year for the entire season. I have no idea what attracted it.
Well, I'm sure it was the woods growing larger, and I would suggest you can go out and find a good log in the woods or take your chair and just go out and sit and listen to where it's singing and maybe move a little bit closer. You know, they are territorial this time of year. The migration for wood thrushes is pretty well over, even though I'm sure there's probably a few birds still moving, especially in the northern part of the state. But, you know, with a little persistence, since they are good singers, you should be able to find it. It'll be fairly low down to the ground. They don't perch way up in the tops of trees. So I would just go out there and work at it a few evenings.
Maureen, good luck to you on your search for the bird. And let's go to Patty in Madison next. Hello, Patty.
Hello, and your program is so timely. We just did a 3-day camping trip down the Namekagon, mm-hmm. and on our last day that we were about 6 miles away from St. Croix, when we were setting up camp at dusk, there was a whippoorwill that was singing incredibly. And then like an hour after dusk, there was a bird that we think was a whippoorwill that was pretty much dive-bombing us around the campfire. And I was just wondering if that's a common thing. I mean, we first thought it was a bat, and then it actually landed very close to the fire, and we could actually see it. And the people we were with who had actually seen a whippoorwillow before thought for sure that was it, and definitely that's the only song that you heard at that time. Well, and I'm just wondering if you can tell us more about that.
When you're saying dive bombing, was it swooping at you, or do you think it was feeding at maybe bugs that were attracted near the flames?
Well, you know, that's a good question. There were a lot of gnats out. It did seem to be, I mean, one of the people we were with had actually touched the back of her hair, and it almost dive-bombed into the fire. So it could have been that it was...
Whippoorwills have this huge mouth, and little gnats is not going to be their food of choice. It'll be the bigger moths, and they're sometimes attracted around the flames. So I was wondering perhaps that, or if perhaps you were camping in an area that was right near its territory that was becoming a bit aggressive.
Okay.
Was this an open area, or was it a forested area that you were in?
It was a forested area. There was lots of pines, high pines, and then actually there were a lot of birch trees around it as well. So, but it was pretty open right where we were. But we were in the middle of nowhere on the Namekagon, so there wasn't a lot of any. It was pure forest anywhere around us except right by the river.
Are you sure it wasn't a bat?
Yeah, because it actually landed,
okay.
So you could see it, and I just couldn't get a good. I thought it looked like it was a little bit bigger, but someone else in the group thought it would look like a whippoorwill. And truly, that was the only sound that we were hearing at that time. And they sang all night long, and they woke us up bright and early in the morning.
They can't be persistent, can't they?
They sure can. It was the first time I had ever heard one, and it was incredible because the day before when we had camped probably about 6 miles away, one felt like he was right on top of our tent singing away at 5 in the morning. So.
Well, they nest on the ground, and I'm guessing, as Bill suggests, maybe there was a nest site nearby, and it was just a little agitated by your presence.
And when I read in the book, it sounds like they nest on the ground?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And is it something that you could actually see as a nest, or is it really kind of...
It's hardly much of a nest structure. They'll just look for a little leafy depression just to lay the eggs, and always good camouflage. So it's a tough thing to actually sight.
Okay.
They'll often be in a little trail or maybe a little opening. You know, they will not, the nest or the eggs will not be beneath a shrub or anything like that. It'll be out in a little opening. And usually about the only way to find them is you're just walking through the forest and you'll flush one up from the ground. If you search very intently, you'll very often be able to find the eggs. And as Bill mentioned, there's really not a nest per se as we think of nests. But they're such an interesting bird to have.
Patty.
Yeah, it was very exciting to hear it. I had never heard one before, and to hear it 3 days in a row, and then to really have one, you know, that was that close to us.
I think that's perhaps the alarming thing about the decline of a bird like this is it's not just a conservation concern. And when you do hear them, I mean, it's a very unique song, and when it's common enough and calling, it can almost be annoying. But what would the forest be like if there was silence and we didn't hear things like whippoorwills anymore?
Yeah, I grew up in southern Ohio, and they used to perch on our rooftop, as many as three at once, all singing. And my classmates would visit me, and they had trouble sleeping at night. And of course, I grew up with it and heard it all the night. So, it was great to have them there.
And Patty, thank you very much for that observation. And let's go to Dave next in Bridge Creek. Hello, Dave.
Hi, this is a great show. We feed up to 15, 20 hummingbirds every summer. and they empty the feeders daily. And I was wondering, would it hurt to up the sugar content from 25%? And also, is it harmful to feed and concentrate that many birds in one little area?
I wouldn't increase the sugar content much more. That's the general recommended amount for it. There is a little bit of a concern in some areas, particularly some of these lodges in the tropics where they are bringing in birds with these feeders. And it's quick, easy food, but perhaps it's a bit of junk food for them. I think they certainly take advantage of it. And here we've got a good insect hatch, so there's plenty of food to supplement it with. But there are at least some concerns out there that as we try to lure these birds in and make it easy, that it's not always the rounded diets, especially, say, at some of these lodges where they've got varieties of birds in the subtropics and tropics. And, you know, it's a great show, and I love hummingbird feeders when I travel. It's a great way to bring them in. But I think maybe there's a little bit of caution of just perhaps overdoing it.
Well, I certainly agree. 4-to-1 ratio is what you want to stick with.
The only other question I have is, you said up to 15. How do you count them? Because those guys are so fast and they're coming and going. Unless you've got them all at once, it's a hard to keep track of who's who out there, isn't it?
Well, right before dusk, they kind of come in
like
swarms,
the food, yeah.
And they all get along, so they land on a half a dozen feeders, and you can say, yeah, there's four, 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 and four on each feeder really quick.
Especially
but,
with some of these
cool
nights.
That's pretty quick.
Yeah, with some of these cool nights and before they've all settled in for nesting, you can concentrate them a little bit.
Good. Yep. Okay.
Dave, thank you very much for the call. And here's a follow-up from Rebecca in Platteville. She emails, does the kind of sugar matter to hummingbirds, whether it's cane or beet?
Well, don't use honey. That's the main rule of thumb. But as far as granulated sugar, no, it does not make any difference what the source is.
She's saying that she feeds grape jelly to the Orioles and have recently noticed the cheaper brands of jelly are made of corn syrup instead of pure grapes, and wonders if that's harmful to the birds.
I don't believe it is, no.
All right. Answers the question. Let's go to Jane next in Menominee. Hello, Jane. Menominee Falls.
Yes. Hi. Wonderful show. I've had a hummingbird at my feeder 4 years ago over 4th of July that was the most unique color, and I have never since seen it, and I have looked online and never found anything that matches that description. It was almost black. It was very, very dark, and it had a neon ring that was yellow around the neck. And the first day, it looked just like a neon ring. The second day when it came, as it flew away, I noticed that the whole chest was neon yellow. And I call it my extinct hummingbird because I've never been able to find any description matching that.
Were you able to get any photographs of it?
You know, the second day I had my camera all set up and nothing happened. I picked up my coffee cup, and as it was at my lips, I looked and went, no, and grabbed my camera, and it was gone.
Well, you've got our attention.
I am just so upset about that.
I was going to say, you've got our attention because we're always looking for some of these unusual occurrences of Western hummingbirds that may come into Wisconsin. Yellow, however, is not a common color for hummingbirds, and I'm wondering if perhaps that wasn't pollen on the bird.
Well, it was very neon, very neon, and it did cover the chest. As it flew, it angled off the second day, and the chest was neon yellow as well. And I do have a friend of my mother's who lives in Mequon at the lake, and she has belonged to the Ornithology Association and all. And she described something like that a week later at her feeder and had called me because she had heard that I had seen an unusual hummingbird, and our descriptions actually matched. And it's bothered me that I haven't told anybody about this for 4 years.
Well, you've stumped the experts,
yeah,
I believe.
With a dark back, yeah.
Well, I spent the rest of the summer with my camera and no coffee, and it never came
back. Never came
back.
So,
if he does call.
Yeah. If it comes back, be sure and go to Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, the WSObirds.org, and report it there.
Okay, I certainly will. Gosh, I would love to see it again.
Jane, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Our guests, of course, are Noel Cutright, who's the current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. He was senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Bill Volkert is a wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR at the Horican Marsh National Wildlife Area. As we talk about birds today, I know that there is a festival coming up this weekend at Washington Island, the Door Islands Bird Festival. Do either of you attend that?
I do not, but these bird festivals are becoming more common. It's a great way for people to enjoy some of the highlight birds in special regions around the state and certainly around the country. And I'm glad to see that there's a new one coming online up for that area, because the Door County Peninsula certainly has always been a good bird-watching hotspot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've not been able to attend it either, but I know one of the organizers is the publicity chair for WSO, Ursula, and she's done a lot of work with that, as other people in Door County have, Washington Island have. WSO's considering hosting its next convention up in Door County, so it's just a grand location to have, and of course, Bill was very active with the Horican Marsh, and I led a trip out there last 2 weekends ago also, and it's great to see all these bird festivals around Wisconsin, whether it's the one up in the Ashland-Bayfield area, Schwamigan, or the one that they have out for the prairie chickens in April. It's just a wonderful thing that we're seeing more and more festivals around the state.
Robert in Stevens Point, let's go to you. Hi.
Good morning.
Yes.
Say, I'd like to tell you about a curious incident that began a couple of weeks ago in my yard. I heard a metallic tapping sound and just took note that it perhaps was some kids playing out a rhythm on something metal. Then I went outside and saw that it was a hairy woodpecker tapping away on a stop sign at the corner of my yard. And this went on for a few minutes, and it's happened a few times now. And we're wondering what this woodpecker may be doing.
He's looking for a good instrument. Woodpeckers do not have a real varied vocalization. The little peeps and the alert notes, the chattering is about all they do. So when it comes to the nesting season, they're not good songsters. Instead, they'll do drumming. And so they're looking for, normally, a log of a particular type of a resonance to it to carry the sound, and then the different woodpeckers will tap at a different rate and a different tonal quality to the log they're looking for. And you can sometimes pick out the different species by the way they tap. Occasionally gutters, or this is the first time I've heard of a stop sign, something that's just got a good rattle to it, it carries that sound. That seems to catch his ear. Don't know if it's working for the female or not, but that's really what he's looking for.
And sometimes it can be your gutter on your house, which if you think birds fluttering against your window can be disturbing in the morning to a good sleep. If one finds your downspout and starts using that as its drumming locations, there's another whole instance of poor sleep in the morning.
Well, this sound carries for quite a distance.
Yes.
It's quite loud and quite rhythmic. And we haven't seen the female, but perhaps we will.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks
the thing
a lot.
That astounds me about this is that the grade of metal there is pretty stout, and I don't know if there's much that gives. He's got to be pretty persistent. I don't know if they get much of a headache from that. Usually wood, when they tap on that, there's at least a little bit of give in that soft wood. This guy, it's that breeding season, you know, they'll go through anything.
I had a breeding bird survey up in Marinette County. I've been running for several years, and there was one stop sign there. I would have a woodpecker just about every year drumming on the sign. So they have wooden posts up there to support the sign, so they just cling on the wood and just hammer away at that stop sign. It seemed like every year I came past, there would be one there using that as their drumming post.
Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure, and the time has flown too swiftly, and we'll look forward to a return visit.
Well, we always enjoy it, Jim, very much.
Thanks, Noel.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Bill, thank you very much. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, our guests today. And if you'd like a CD of the program, you go to the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Our thanks to Brittany DeAnda for on-air production. Tomorrow, Larry's back. He'll be talking with Michael Feldman, the host and author of What Do You Know, a new book, and then our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Thanks for listening.